Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. A recent headline in late September on the popular science magazine's website read, DARPA gives MIT lab $32 million to program living cells. DARPA stands for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, a secretive government agency that spearheads bizarre-sounding scientific research. And that headline was fairly typical of the type of project the agency oversees. On its website, it says DARPA pursues opportunities for transformational change rather than incremental advances. But the question is, what sort of transformation and why? While DARPA has been the subject of speculation by conspiracy theorists since its founding in 1958, no one has actually written a definitive history of the agency until now. My guest is Annie Jacobson. She is a journalist and the author of the New York Times bestsellers Area 51 and Operation Paperclip. She was a contributing editor at the LA Times magazine. She's a graduate of Princeton University, and her book is called The Pentagon's Brain, an Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency. Welcome to Uprising, Annie.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I have to admit that when I first saw your book, opened up the envelope, looked at the title, I kind of immediately, for a second, dismissed it as some sort of possibly conspiracy theory-filled diatribe against the Illuminati and the government's secret agenda to control all our minds. And then I realized it was published by a mainstream publisher. And I opened the book and I thought, oh, this might be the real deal. How do people treat your book when they first see it? Do you get some skepticism?
You know, I think I have all kinds of readers, which is actually, as you know, the job of the journalist to inform the public. And so when you have readers on both sides of the aisle and from all over the planet, you get a sense of perhaps I'm doing my job, which is really to present the facts. And, you know, The Pentagon's Brain, it's sort of like a hot title, but in essence, it speaks to the fact that I write about these great minds that have been producing this radical science since 1958. They are, in essence, the Pentagon's brains, and then DARPA, that agency, functions as the Pentagon's brain.
So you spoke with more than 70 people affiliated with DARPA, which is quite amazing. And you sort of stitched together this history going all the way back to the founding. And I want to ask you about the people involved, but first, the founding of DARPA. The story goes that the Soviet Union Sputnik motivated and the launch of Sputnik motivated the creation of DARPA. Of course, it was a little bit more complex than that. This was in the 50s. We had invented the atomic bomb. The Cold War was starting. And then there was this sense that the U.S. was falling behind, that we had to measure up to the Soviet Union. Tell us that story briefly.
Yes, well, it's very specific. I mean, when the Russians launched Sputnik, they had beaten us into space. And that caused, in essence, panic in America. DARPA was set up just a few weeks later, very specifically, so that America would never again be taken by technological surprise, which is exactly what DARPA has done. So it really is a double-edged sword. I mean, they produce some of the most amazing science that finds its way into your and my lives, the internet, GPS, the list goes on. But they're also responsible for, and keep this in mind, this was the mandate of DARPA when it was created, to create vast weapon systems of the future. And that is a spooky idea. They are about weapons.
And initially, this started out as ARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency. The D, the defense, was tacked on in 1973. Right after the Vietnam War, people were tired of war, and it's arguable whether that actually changed much about DARPA's approach. But how did how did DARPA get set up? Because I was really surprised at its structure. There are an unusually tiny number of people actually employed in this organization. It has an unusual degree of flexibility and autonomy that most government agencies do not have the luxury of having. It only employs about 120 people.
Those are called program managers, and you're absolutely right. So it has this lack of red tape, which makes it really unique and very effective. Consider this. DARPA's budget this year is $3 billion. Divide that by 120 program managers.
Oh my goodness.
You can see the power that each of those individual program managers have. They then reach out to academic universities, military laboratories, industry, and they create and build their programs with those very large budgets with extreme flexibility that you referred to.
So that headline that I mentioned, you know, $32 million here, very likely many other universities and research think tanks getting tons of money. One of these, RAND Corporation, based right here in Southern California, has deeply been involved in DARPA research, but it was also involved quite early on in the start of this, in the founding of DARPA, right? Tell us the link between RAND and DARPA.
Absolutely. I mean, RAND was seen as sort of like the nuclear think tank. They were really, they helped the Pentagon calculate death numbers for nuclear war. And in the 50s, they had that reputation as sort of the dark thinkers. Well, when the Vietnam War came along, suddenly DARPA was involved, then called ARPA, was involved in all kinds of weaponry. I mean, conventional weapons, advanced weapons. For example, ARPA developed the Agent Orange program. And they also became involved in social science and anthropology, which on face you think, oh, well, that's interesting. But when you really look at it and you couple it with ARPA's absolute pioneering efforts in computers, you realize behavior was looked at toward a means of behavior modification, of behavior examination, of surveillance. And RAND absolutely took the lead. They decided amongst themselves, I write about this in the book, wait a minute, we must spread out from the business of, you know, nuclear death toll and nuclear think tank into, you know, a broader spectrum of work. And so they really, you know, took on a new level of you know, thinking for the Pentagon starting in the Vietnam War. And of course, now they are in a huge position with DARPA.
And I want to get to where we are now. Let's talk about the people that you interviewed. How did you find them? 71 people involved and affiliated in various ways with DARPA. How forthcoming were they? How did you locate them?
People often say to me, you know, how on earth did you write about DARPA? They won't answer my call. And that is true. I often say DARPA's press office is really an advertising agency.
Right.
They have their own agenda. You read that incredibly lofty, beneficent quote. That is what DARPA does well. They promote themselves as this agency that is advancing science and technology for our benefit, which they are in part. What you don't ever hear from DARPA is this, you know, the other stories. And that is important that the public knows what DARPA has been doing for all these decades, the good, the bad, the ugly, the nefarious, the failures, the successes. You want to be able to, as a citizen, see brilliance and hubris. You want to see these revolutionizing moments in history, but you also need to see what has gone wrong and why. That's what I write in the book.
That's our money. Let's, you know, be so clear with this. And that was one of the things that made me angry when I read this book. You know, the luxury that these 120 people have to distribute $3 billion of our money to develop weapons, to develop advanced weapons, to be inspired by science fiction, and when I get into that, and to have so little accountability, which is exactly how they want it, and which is actually what makes them set the trend. And one other thing that I thought about when I was reading your book is, you know, in the retail world, when Walmart starts doing it, everybody follows. In the world of military research, when DARPA starts doing it, I realized that everybody else in the world follows. And one of the questions around that is drone warfare. Can we thank DARPA, ironically, of course, for the invention of drones that are now being adopted all over the world by all other countries who go, wow, this is a great idea. We can drop weapons without hurting, you know, people ourselves, hurting our own people.
There's so much to learn in that specificity of looking at drone research with DARPA, yes. So it goes all the way back to the Vietnam War. How surprising is that to think drones were being used in the Vietnam War in 1968? And yet the American public didn't even, save a few military experts, did not even know about drones until they made an appearance on the battlefield in Afghanistan in October 2002. And think about this. At the time, we were the only nation that had armed drones in Afghanistan, okay? Today, 186 nations have armed drones. DARPA is so far along into other forms of robotic warfare because it must always stay ahead. It must always be the agency creating what the Pentagon calls revolution in military affairs.
So the Vietnam War, where it sort of pioneered biological warfare, you know, pesticide sprays to remove foliage and make it easier for aerial bombardment of the Viet Cong, which of course invariably led to mass quote-unquote collateral damage and Agent Orange, shouldn't that have led to a serious distaste for this kind of research?
Well, it did. And that's the, you know, when you spoke earlier of how DARPA got its D for defense. The irony there is that when it was called ARPA, after the Vietnam War, ARPA got in a lot of trouble for doing what Congress saw as like unnecessary military research. And there was a mandate then to only start doing necessary defense work, hence the D for DARPA. But something exactly the opposite happened, which is that DARPA was moved out of the Pentagon. It was kind of banished a couple miles away, which was considered a demotion. But there's an amazing moment there where suddenly, left to its own, DARPA is able to pioneer science and technology as an industry inside the Pentagon, even though it's outside of the Pentagon. And so that's when you see this incredible buildup of drone warfare. It was something the Pentagon, or rather DARPA, called offset strategy. It's fighting wars from a distance, putting the drones in play, ultimately putting robots in play. And what you have now is remarkably spooky when you're looking at DARPA's plans, I think spooky, for what is called autonomous warfare.
Yeah.
Having the robots be self-governing, no longer controlled by a drone operator, but taking the human out of the mix and building, you know, into the robot a program to go be a hunter-killer robot on its own.
Okay, we are not talking about Battlestar Galactica here. We're talking about a U.S. government agency funded by taxpayer dollars. So this super soldier that you've written about, this future warrior, is something that really sounds like the stuff of science fiction. But in fact, DARPA has also, and DARPA staff have actually looked to science fiction for inspiration.
Well, actually, the DARPA director said just a few days ago at the Aspen conference, everything is science fiction until it becomes real. And that is exactly what DARPA is about. But you mentioned this DARPA programs that I write about to move us towards, you know, hunter-killer robots, but it is actually Pentagon dogma. Mm. And this was remarkable to look at these, yes, very thick 300-page documents, but anyone can read them. They are unclassified, and they talk about the Pentagon's position to move toward this kind of warfare. And people still think of this as something, you know, a way off, far out sci-fi idea, when in fact, when you realize, when you look at the history of DARPA, what DARPA says, it actually does. Mm. So those plans are in play. They're in play for 20 years in the future, but those machines are being built now.
So what is exactly the relationship between DARPA and the Pentagon? Let's talk about how it works. It's now, the DARPA is housed a few miles out away from the Pentagon. Does DARPA set its own agenda and then turn over research findings to the Pentagon, or does the Pentagon give it assignments?
Well, that is a great question. It's an interplay. So the DARPA director reports to the Undersecretary of Defense. And at many times throughout history, you see the DARPA director reporting directly to the Secretary of Defense. So that's sort of like a hierarchy, but you can see that interplay. And by the way, you can also see how the DARPA director is working with the Secretary of Defense and often the President in times of war. So it is such a close hand-in-glove relationship. And on the outside, you have Congress. And when I say on the outside, I really mean that, because Congress is simply authorizing this $3 billion budget that the President requests and then goes back to DARPA. But by the way, that $3 billion is just the publicly known budget. There are always black budgets. We know that. And that is not reported. So the exact sum total of money that DARPA is working with is unknown.
My guest is Annie Jacobson. We're talking about her book, The Pentagon's Brain, An Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency. You point out in your book this very bizarre-sounding group of scientists that work with DARPA called the Jasons. I mean, this sounds like the sort of nerd equivalent of Skull and Bones.
Well, if anyone listening is a conspiracy theorist, and I say that with, you know, I have a lot of readers who subscribe to that idea, and I always say they're not entirely wrong. Many of their facts are actually accurate.
Right.
It's just where it goes, yeah. Okay? But the Jason scientists are right up there with the Illuminati in many people's minds. I found quite the opposite to be true. I interviewed for this book Marvin Goldberger, called Murph to his friends, just passed at the age of 90. But he was the co-founder of the Jason scientists back in 1960, advising ARPA on the most complicated problems of science. The Pentagon actually called them the supermen of science.
So are they just some sort of a self-described, like, a secret fraternity of scientists?
Well,
they invite a fellow scientist to join?
Yes, you must be invited.
Mostly men, I'm guessing?
They now have one woman.
Okay.
But they are mostly, at last count, they had one woman. But we're a little behind the public times. But, you know, they were primarily nuclear physicists and engineers in the beginning. But as I write in the book, after the wall came down and we learned about the Soviet bioweapons program, suddenly there was a whole bunch of biologists in the mix. And that really shifted things for the Jason scientists and also for DARPA.
How did DARPA adapt to a multipolar world after the Cold War ended?
With flexibility, again, giving credit where credit is due, suddenly DARPA had this whole new world it had to defend against, and it began to understand bioweapons, and also, not that it didn't understand them before, but it didn't realize the threat that was actually clear and present, because the Soviets were actually developing bioweapons and had an arsenal of them. And also, right around that same time, DARPA realized it had to defend against urban warfare. And of course, that is so much what we see now. One interesting DARPA document I came across was actually written by the RAND Corporation for DARPA, and it said, when it was talking about urban warfare and how we wanted to avoid it, the quote was from Sun Tzu, that Chinese military general from 2,500 years ago, and it said, "It is the worst policy to attack cities."
The art of war, yeah.
So we have DARPA trying to learn how to defend against these urban warfare environments, not with great success. And of course, just read the headlines and see how that impossibility right now, DARPA has a lot of great minds working on how to possibly address that, because it is a big conundrum.
So right there, I think, is a really good point to discuss that despite all of this military capability, on September 11th, 2001, DARPA's technology did not save the United States. And all it took was, you pointed out, something like the whole operation of Al-Qaeda cost them less than $500,000 to hit the biggest, you know, most powerful, most militarily powerful country in the world. And in the end, human ingenuity that is driven by desperation and anger at the weapons that DARPA has delivered may often prove to be able to undermine the most sophisticated weapons.
And that's exactly what happened. But another important thing happened at that same moment, which is that...
And I don't mean to sound admiring of what they did, of course.
No, but you're making an absolutely clear, critical point. But there was a flip side of that in terms of DARPA, which is that suddenly the amount of money that Congress was willing to give DARPA to defend against that attack that you refer to on 9/11.
That they failed to prevent.
Was bigger than any amount of money since Sputnik. Mm. And so there's a great irony and also again, that idea of the double-edged sword coming into play at that exact moment in history.
So you have these super soldiers now that inform the future of what DARPA's research is going into. And in a way, the weaponized drones are a precursor to that, right? Somebody sitting in a control center in Nevada can drop a bomb in Afghanistan without physically getting hurt. They might have some mental PTSD from, you know, from killing ordinary people, but they can remain physically intact and drop a bomb from many, many thousands of miles away. In the future, will we see, dare I say, weaponized ground troops?
DARPA calls them the dismounted soldier. And absolutely, DARPA has recently teamed up with Special Forces, with Special Operations Command, and is creating what the president called it was the Iron Man suit. He called it that in jest mm-hmm. at a press conference in the White House. Mm-hmm. But in essence, that's what it is. And this, believe it or not, is a DARPA idea going back to the 1980s. The idea that the soldier's physiology and cognition needs to be enhanced, can be enhanced, and therefore should be enhanced by mechanical and other means. And that's where you get the soldier, the super soldier, both with a super soldier suit and also this idea of looking inside the body to enhance cognition. And there you get into some very controversial ideas. I write about in this in the book about, you know, implanting neuroprosthetics, otherwise known as brain chips, in the brains, the soft tissue of the brain of soldiers. And that's a big debate that is presently going on right now inside the Pentagon, not as far as the public is concerned.
So is this research in development right now, in a development stage?
They're in clinical trials, absolutely.
It's gone that far.
Absolutely. And they're being used right now with veterans. So 2.5 million soldiers went to the war on terror. 300,000 came home with brain injuries. And those veterans with cognitive impairment are being used in these clinical trials to see if DARPA can have a program to, quote unquote, repair cognitive functioning. But there are also other issues, which brings me to this document that I found, again, unclassified, written by the Jason scientists who I interviewed, which warned the Pentagon and DARPA against this kind of research, specifically because, and these are their words, not mine, it could lead to high-quality brain control.
Wow. Did any of the people involved with DARPA that you interviewed express fear, regret, remorse for what DARPA has done and enabled and might enable?
On balance, no. Wow. The majority of scientists and engineers who work for DARPA are extremely grateful to be able to do what they do, which is push science. And they also talk about how many private institutions will not invest in what DARPA calls pre-requirement research. So right here in California, down in Irvine, I interviewed two scientists who have what is called a limb regeneration lab. They believe humans should be able to, and one day will be able to, regenerate lost limbs. Not just lost in the war theater, but, say, lost in an accident. The kind of research they're doing, very few people will invest in because it's 25 years out. DARPA gave them a multi-million dollar contract, which they were very grateful for, and were able to do, according to them, research that they absolutely would not have been able to do, progress that they could not have made without DARPA.
So is it fair to say that some of this research, of course, has some extremely positive impacts, but DARPA can always see a weaponized use for them, these dual-purpose research?
Absolutely, everything is dual-purpose. Although for DARPA, I believe it has one purpose, which is to create the vast military weapons of the future. For the rest of us, it has a dual purpose. But consider this. There was one bit of remorse that was shared with me by the co-founder of the Jason scientist, Murph Goldberger. And it was curious what it was. Now, Goldberger worked on the Manhattan Project. He helped develop the atomic bomb. He had no remorse about that, believed that it won the war and saved lives. His remorse came from Vietnam. And he said to me, we should never have gotten involved in Vietnam. But in the bigger picture, his remorse came from the fact, he said, that he spent his life working on defense problems when he wished he had been pursuing pure science. Science for the fact of ultimately what he said was being one of those few who might do something important enough to be, you know, recommended for a Nobel.
You ask in your book, is it wise to let DARPA determine what lies ahead? Having written this history, what is your personal answer to that question?
Well, again, the job of the journalist is to inform the public.
Yeah.
With that said, because I write about nuclear weapons in the beginning of the book and the incredible danger that they posed and still pose, and I must, you know, remind myself and others that nuclear weapons cannot launch themselves. So the reason we have stayed, you know, outside of World War III is because they can't launch themselves. I do see a great potential disaster in artificially intelligent robots because they can launch themselves.
Yeah. Annie, thank you so much for joining us today and for your work.
Thank you for having me.
Annie Jacobson is author of The Pentagon's Brain, an Uncensored History of DARPA, America's Top Secret Military Research Agency.